This is number 0038, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0038. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we'll meet Anthony Del Call, one of the co-authors of Kill Shakespeare. Remember back in your school days when the topic of Shakespeare came up? Sometimes students would just roll their eyes.
And that's because there are so many bad teachers, or a lot of bad methods of teaching or introducing Shakespeare to people. And that's one of the things that we want to do with Kill Shakespeare, our comic book series, is to reintroduce Shakespeare in a whole new different way. I mean, Shakespeare, when he wrote his productions, he wrote them to be performed. They're full of energy, they're very kinetic, and a lot of the times when you just read it in class, that energy just isn't there. So with Kill Shakespeare, what we really want to do is just kind of show that Shakespeare has everything in his production. I mean, he's got love and romance, he's got the beautiful poetry, but more importantly, he's got action, he's got adventure, he's got drama, he's got double-crossing, cross-dressing, and he's got everything that's basically been told and retold for the last 400 years. It's kind of the archetypes with characters and stories.
Dr. James Sears, one of the doctors on the hit syndicated TV show The Doctors, he's on the program. You know, there's a lot of medical information out there, some good, some bad, especially on the internet.
We've said this on the show, you know, the internet is great for researching something that if you've already been diagnosed with something, the internet is a great tool for linking up with other people with the same problem, things like that, and maybe finding specialists. But in terms of trying to diagnose yourself, you know, the internet can be a scary place.
And remembering Helen Wagner, the grand dame of As the World Turns. Sadly, she recently passed away, but luckily, I have an old interview from several years ago when she was a guest on our old radio show. The audience really responded to her character of Nancy Hughes, a character she played for over 50 years.
Oh, I used to get great mail castigating me. Why don't you leave those kids alone? Let them do what they want to. Well, that was fine, you know, just as long as people wrote, even if they didn't like it very much. As long as they wrote, you knew they were attending and were interested in the show.
And, of course, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff. And an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0038, is Toby Goodfellow, a freelance writer and communications specialist and a former colleague of mine when we both worked at that other place. But now he's branched out on his own, and you can check out his website at goodfellowcommunication.ca. That's goodfellowcommunication.ca. And thank you very much, Toby, for being the guest later on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff. We start off with a story from Northampton, Massachusetts. The victim might have forgiven the woman who ran him down in a Massachusetts crosswalk, but the police haven't. Police say a Pittsfield woman has been cited for running down a man named Lord Jesus Christ. Yeah, that's his name. As he crossed a street in Northampton. The 50-year-old man is from Belchertown. Officers checked his ID and discovered that, indeed, his legal name is Lord Jesus Christ. He was taken to the hospital for treatment of minor facial injuries. Police say 20-year-old Brittany Cantarella was cited for failing to yield to a pedestrian in a crosswalk. Now, you know, this is an interesting kind of story, and a big enough story because the fellow's name was Lord Jesus Christ, although it would be a much bigger story if she didn't hit him with a car while he was walking. It would have been a much bigger story if she hit him with a speedboat. Anyway. Moving right along, we go to Oregon for our next story. Okay, this one is almost too strange for words. A man who befriended high school athletes in Washington and Oregon and asked them for piggyback rides has been arrested. Police arrested the man at a hotel in Oregon on a drug-related warrant from Mount Vernon, Washington. An officer had seen him in recent days at a school event. The Oregon School Activities Association had advised athletes to look out for the suspect after he turned up at games in Eugene and Pendleton. Executive Director Tom Welter said the man talked his way into locker rooms and got piggyback rides from some players. Terry Carter of the Bonnie Lake, Washington Police Department said the man had given a player money, then jumped on his back for a piggyback ride. Can we all just take a minute and ponder that visual? No, really. I don't know what's more bizarre. A guy going into a locker room and paying somebody, some athlete, to give him a piggyback ride, or a total stranger walking into your locker room and you agreeing to give him a piggyback ride for money. I don't know which is more bizarre. You be the judge. Anyway, moving right along. Ever wondered what the internet tastes like? Well, now you can find out thanks to Toscanini's Ice Cream Parlor in Boston near MIT. They will soon be debuting their newest ice cream flavor, Internet. So how in the world could you make internet-flavored ice cream? Turns out the recipe is fairly simple, I guess. It's just pure vanilla ice cream base with nerds in it. That's basically how I make internet ice cream, I'm guessing. Moving right along, we go to Germany for our next story. A German postman has married his obese and asthmatic cat, Cecilia. Cecilia, you're breaking my heart. You're shaking my confidence daily. Anyway, he married Cecilia, saying he wanted to tie the knot before his elderly furry friend dies. Cecilia is such a trusting creature. We cuddle all the time, and she's always been sleeping in my bed. This is a quote from the very single, and you know why now, Uwe Mitterlich, age 39, from Possendorf near Dresden in eastern Germany. Our hearts beat as one. It's unique. Oh, it's unique, pal. Because marrying an animal is illegal, Uwe paid 300 euros, that's about $400 US, to a television actress to play officiator in the ceremony while the groom's twin brother Eric served as witness. I'm just wondering, how weird is Eric? The happy couple dressed up for the occasion, Uwe in a wedding suit and top hat, and 15-year-old Cecilia, who loudly meowed her way through the exchanging of vows, in a white dress. If anybody speaks cat, I'm sure the cat was saying, "Get me the hell out of here." Anyway, let's continue the nuptial theme, shall we, as we wing our way to Australia. 44-year-old Nicholas Trakillis wasn't thinking too clearly when he had pictures of his wedding and his new bride published in the newspaper. That's because his first wife, whom he is still married to, just happens to read the paper. Turns out he had forged divorce papers for the new marriage. When the other wife saw the photos, she called police. Nick has since pleaded guilty to bigamy, forgery, and giving false information in court. He got 6 months in prison, which was suspended for 5 years and ordered to pay a fine of $1,800. No word, by the way, on whether either wife wants to have anything to do with him any longer. But I'm guessing not. Meanwhile, let's go to the UK to check on the latest absurdity in the nanny state. In England, 2-year-old Jack Ormister burst into tears when a teacher at his nursery school took his cheese sandwich that he brought for lunch. She did it because it didn't contain any lettuce or tomato and was considered too unhealthy by the staff. His mother, 32-year-old Dorothy Gallier, was outraged and has now changed schools. She claimed Jack was not allowed to have his cheese sandwich for lunch because it was not on a list of menu options such as fruit, vegetables, pasta, or potatoes. But bizarrely, she was told the sandwich would have been all right if it had contained some lettuce or tomato, as then it would have been classed as only a snack, not a sandwich. Yeah. The nanny state. God love 'em. Okay, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. On the line with us right now is Anthony Del Call, who is one of the creators, along with Connor McCreary, of Kill Shakespeare, which is a 12-part comic book series featuring Shakespeare's most famous heroes. Thanks for joining us, Anthony. This is an interesting concept. I take it that you were a Shakespeare fan to begin with. Is that an accurate assumption?
Yeah, you are 100% correct on that. It's kind of funny because the business partnership, or the creative partnership as well that I have with Connor, I'm kind of the Shakespeare geek and Connor's kind of the comic book geek. So with Kill Shakespeare is an idea that both of us came up with. And I mean, we both, you know, I've been a huge fan of Shakespeare for years. I've gone to the Shakespeare Festival, I'd say probably at least for, you know, the last 15 years or so. I love Shakespeare, and I mean just the whole process of going to a theater or watching a film version and just realizing that Shakespeare is the greatest writer and the greatest entertainer of all time. I mean, the greatest characters and the greatest stories. And so for us to be able to, and kill Shakespeare, put all these great characters and stories together, I mean, it's kind of a dream project.
Who do you see your primary audience for this? Because as I'm sure you're aware, again, being a Shakespeare geek, as you mentioned, that sometimes when you mention Shakespeare, especially to school kids, their eyes kind of roll back.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And that's because there are so many, I guess you'd say, a lot of bad teachers or a lot of bad methods of teaching or introducing Shakespeare to people. And that's one of the things that we want to do with Kill Shakespeare, our comic book series, is to, you know, kind of reintroduce Shakespeare in a whole new different way. I mean, Shakespeare, when he wrote his productions, he wrote them to be performed. They're full of energy. They're very kinetic. And a lot of the times when you just read it in class, that energy just isn't there. So with Kill Shakespeare, what we really want to do is just kind of, you know, show that, you know, Shakespeare has everything in his productions. I mean, he's got love and romance, he's got the beautiful poetry, but more importantly, he's got action, he's got adventure, he's got drama, he's got, you know, double-crossing, cross-dressing, and he's got everything that's basically been told and retold for the last 400 years. It's kind of the archetypes with characters and stories. So our audience... yes, we want to tackle the academics, but we want to tackle the students. But I mean, we want to, you know, we've tried to write this so it appeals to everybody. So as long as you like a good action story or a good adventure story, like say Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter or anything like that, then you can really get into Kill Shakespeare.
Would you like it then to be actually used in schools?
Yes. I think that is something that really excites us about this project. We've spoken to a lot of librarians, we've spoken to a lot of academics, a lot of teachers, and they're all really excited about the fact that this could be, and it's always funny when we mention this, but and this is an academic that used this term originally, but this could be a gateway drug for kids to really get them excited and jazzed about Shakespeare. Now, we've already been approached by a lot of teachers that want to start teaching, start incorporating this into their classrooms and get them excited, and yeah, I mean, that's what really gets us jazzed. As I said, I mean, we want to redefine Shakespeare for a whole new generation and kind of say that, you know what, you know, Juliet is pretty hot and Othello is pretty badass, and these are characters that you can really get excited about, and, you know, then you can go on and read their actual stories, you know, say it's, whether it's Othello or Romeo and Juliet.
Now, the interpretations have been described as edgy and a little dark in tone, and the thing that caught my eye, which I'm just wondering if some people may have complained about, the use of modern language. I know there are some Shakespeare purists out there who don't like the idea of the modern language used when referring to Shakespeare. How do you? Obviously, I know how you feel about it. Have you heard anything about it, any backlash on this?
Yes, there has been a bit of backlash with the language on Kill Shakespeare. For the most part, though, I mean, everybody does appreciate it. I mean, even Tom Stoppard, who some people would say is one of the greatest writers today and perhaps the greatest Shakespearean writer, would be, you know, most of the stuff that he's done, whether it's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern or Dead or Shakespeare in Love, which I think is, you know, one of the greatest screenplays of all time. You know, I mean, he wrote a very modern day language with some Shakespeare references or quotations, and that's what we're doing with our production, because often Shakespeare is so inaccessible because of the language. It's written 400 years ago, and it's beautiful and it's poetic, but it's just not accessible by today's audiences. So that's the reason why we did modern language. Now, as you say, there have been some people that have raised an eyebrow, or there's one scholar in particular who really took offense to this. She wrote, it's a scholar by the name of Kimberly Cox, who, coincidentally enough, is also the girlfriend of Frank Miller, who wrote 300 and Sin City and some very integral Batman graphic novel series. But she took offense to this, saying that, you know, it was ridiculous that we did not write this in iambic pentameter, that she wanted to slap us, that you basically, she said in her diatribe that, you know, she threw up in her mouth three times, and basically, I'm not going to tell you why this is bad. Go out and read it for yourself, and it'll make you want to throw up in your mouth.
Well, that's interesting. At least she encouraged people to go out and read it.
Exactly. And that was the thing. We also had one Shakespeare scholar who we invited to sit with us on a panel in San Francisco 3 weeks ago, or 4 weeks ago at the WonderCon there. And he said, I like comics, And I like Shakespeare, but I just don't like the two of them together. I think you're going to ruin the story. However, I don't want to rush to a conclusion on this, so I'll read a couple issues before I make my final call. And so our response was, okay, so we've got him down for three issues. Perfect.
Well, as you just mentioned, the idea of putting things together, it's not just two concepts you put together here, but you put several Shakespeare characters from several of Shakespeare's works in one story, correct?
That's exactly it. Kill Shakespeare is a story where we take all of Shakespeare's greatest heroes, such as Hamlet, Juliet, Othello, Falstaff, Puck, you know, basically all the greatest quote-unquote heroes, and we pit them against Shakespeare's greatest villains, or his most menacing villains, so Richard III, Iago, Lady Macbeth, and they're all on a quest to track down and either kill or save a reclusive wizard by the name of William Shakespeare. So yes, we combine all these characters from all these Shakespearean stories, and I mean every single character, whether it's one of the main characters that I mentioned or even a small character that just has a scene or two, they're all taken from Shakespeare's works.
Now you see, here's where I see the advantage of Kill Shakespeare. I think kids, generally speaking, are curious creatures if given the right impetus. And if I were to read Kill Shakespeare when I was in school, I would want to see where these characters came from. It would make me want to go back and read the actual Shakespeare.
Yep, you're absolutely right. And I mean, that is one of our goals with this, is to kind of highlight the fact that these characters are so active, that they're not just stodgy British characters that your teachers are forcing you to read, but I mean, that they're actually out there and excited. And if Shakespeare was alive today, we would argue that, I mean, he would be doing comic books, he'd be doing films, he'd be doing video games, he'd be doing mobile games and apps for the iPhone or the iPad. I mean, Shakespeare would be a one-man studio today, and you know, because Shakespeare at his when he wrote his plays, I mean, he was a populist. He wrote for the royalty up in the balconies, you know, had their own private balconies or booths, and he wrote for the common folk, you know, the people that would pay a couple ducats, and they'd be standing in the mud for these productions. And I mean, he really wanted to just entertain everybody. And so, you know, we really argue that if Shakespeare was alive today, he'd read comic books, and he'd see it as an excellent way to get this into the classroom.
Again, it's a new 12-part comic book series called Kill Shakespeare. Do you anticipate that there might be more than 12?
Yes, right now we have the 12 issues mapped out. So it's a closed-ended story for that. However, we do have in the works, we have ideas on what we want to do in the second series and the third series. We've always viewed this as a large trilogy because there are so many great characters and so many great stories that we'd love to incorporate. And if we tried to incorporate it all into just one story, it would just be too much. So we have it mapped out, so it would be a full trilogy. And then from there, I mean, we'd love to be able to grow the brand even farther. So there's nothing to say that we can't do prequels or we can't do spin-offs of particular characters. And what's really interesting is that when we talk to a lot of people about this project, a lot of people that we would not expect would know anything about Shakespeare or have any sort of preference or liking of Shakespeare, they actually do like his work, and they like particular characters. So some people say, oh, is King Lear in this one? Oh, what about Iago? What about Hotspur? You know, sometimes it's main characters, sometimes it's obscure characters. But it seems though everybody wants something in there, and we really think that if we're able to do a trilogy of series, then I mean we'd be able to incorporate as many of these characters as possible.
Now, one of the things that is very popular these days as well are taking comics, or what we now call graphic novels, and turning them into film. You are also an independent filmmaker. Do you ever see these jumping from the page to the screen?
Yes, we do. When we first came up with the idea, we viewed it as a massive online role-playing game, very similar to, say, World of Warcraft, where you put all of Shakespeare's characters together, you can select a specific character, and then you can, you know, play against everybody else and battle against everybody else. We then saw it as a film, and then because we'd started to gain a big appreciation for comics, we thought, hey, maybe this is best as a comic book. It's as a great way of introducing the brand to audiences and get people excited about this. But yeah, film is definitely in, not in the works, but I mean, it is in development for us. I mean, we have written a first draft of the screenplay, and we have been approached by companies looking to partner up with us on it. But right now, our focus is on the comic book, just because we want to make this comic series as exciting as possible, get it to a large audience. We really think this could be a crossover success, such as say the Watchmen, you know, as the Watchmen, and get into the classroom and get people excited about Shakespeare.
The series is called Kill Shakespeare. It's a 12-part comic book series, and people can check out the website, which is, by the way, www.killshakespeare.com. Anthony, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation.
Anthony Del Call, one of the creators of Kill Shakespeare. You can check out their website at www.killshakespeare.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0038. And you'll find links to Anthony's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to Dr. James M. Sears, one of the doctors from the hit syndicated series, The Doctors. Also remembering Helen Wagner, who for over 50 years played Nancy Hughes on As the World Turns. She passed away recently. And of course, we have an idiot of the day. But right here, more stuff for you on the Stuff File program. Let's check some of the things that obviously the very rich like to waste their money on. In other words, people with more dollars than cents. Swiss clockmaker Artea announced in March the creation of a wristwatch set in fossilized dinosaur feces with a strap made with skin from an American cane toad. Designer Ivan Arpa said that the watch would sell for about $12,000. $12,000. Dinosaur feces. Meanwhile, the spa 10,000 Waves near Santa Fe, New Mexico, is only the latest U.S. facility to offer as a signature treatment the Japanese Nightingale Facial, supposedly used for centuries by Japanese geisha for skin rejuvenation. Nightingale droppings are dried and sanitized, then spiced with oils and used as a face scrubber. How did one ever decide the concept of saying, gee, see that stuff coming out of the bird? That's probably good for my face. Yeah. And Jimmy Choo stores in New York City quickly sold out recently of their new blinking women's shoes with 5-inch heels, which light up with every step taken at $2,495 a pair, although the unrechargeable battery dies about after 100 uses. Yeah. There's a value for your money. Meanwhile, a North Carolina research organization in March, picking the state's 10 worst destinations for federal stimulus grants, included two ongoing projects at Wake Forest University. Long-term cocaine addiction in monkeys. Let me repeat that for you Americans listening. Yes, there are tax dollars, your tax dollars, going to long-term cocaine addiction in monkeys. And also your tax dollars in the potential benefits of yoga on menopausal hot flashes. There you go. Yeah. Okay, this next story takes playing footsie to a whole new level. In Pleasant Grove, Texas, police have arrested 18-year-old Daniel Wayne Staley, there's that middle name Wayne again, who apparently is so fascinated with death that police say he dug up a grave and used a hatchet to cut off the foot of a corpse. Staley is charged with abuse of a human corpse or grave and could spend up to a year in jail and pay a $4,000 fine. Sergeant Bruce McDonald, a homicide unit supervisor, said, He's infatuated with death and decided to do it. He has some very serious issues and possibly mental problems. You think? He knew what he was doing was wrong. Staley's mother, who asked that her name not be publicized, said her son has been in and out of mental institutions and suffers from a laundry list of illnesses, including schizophrenia. She added that he won't take his medications. Staley's MySpace page makes frequent references to death, and in one photo, he points a gun to his head. On April 19th, he posted that he is, quote, still contemplating the time when I can go and get my corpse. I don't think I could fit the whole thing in my bag. Ew. Okay, who's reading his MySpace page? And more importantly, who's not reporting his MySpace page? That's what I want to know. Okay, from one person with clear issues to another, we take you now to the Sky-West Delta Connection, Flight 4620, which is en route from Helena, Montana to Salt Lake City. But the flight never made it to Salt Lake because it had to make an emergency landing in Idaho Falls. That's because some nutjob started banging on the cockpit door saying he was a space alien and wanted to fly the plane. Flight attendants and other passengers were able to get the man back to his seat while the pilots diverted to Idaho Falls. Authorities waiting at the airport took 32-year-old Matthew E.T. Kleindorfer of Las Vegas into custody. There were about 50 passengers on the plane and nobody was injured. Incredibly inconvenienced, yet no injuries. So, there you go. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, in Longwood, Florida, friends had organized quite an elaborate surprise party for Courtney Rogers' 18th birthday. Her best friend, Brianna Vega, had done all the planning and met Courtney in the parking lot of Dan's family restaurant. The plan was to blindfold Courtney so she would not know the surprise location of her big party where friends and family had gathered. The problem was, people in the restaurant thought Courtney was being kidnapped and called police. While Brianna was pumping gas, police surrounded her Jeep and both girls were suddenly handcuffed, arrested, and, as they claimed, threatened by police. Brianna said, "I mean, I'm a good kid. I get good grades in school. I never thought I'd be arrested, especially being the victim in this situation." The arresting officers had a different version, saying the girls thought the fake kidnapping was funny. Brianna's mother, Trisha Vega, can't believe it and said, "This was something that was not serious. The punishment should fit the crime, and there was no crime." The girls have to go in front of a judge on May 25th and have been told that they could be sentenced to community service. Yes. Well, happy birthday, Courtney. Let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. On the line with us right now is Dr. James M. Sears, who is also known as Dr. Jim on the hit daily syndicated show, The Doctors, which you can find just about everywhere, including Global Television Network here in Canada. As the saying goes, check your local listings. Hey, Dr. Jim, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good, Peter.
I thank you for being on the program with us. The show you are on, The Doctors, has a lot of great information, and I bring that up right off the bat because, unfortunately, with the internet, with television, and with all kinds of things, there's so much information, and sometimes you get medical information that might be a little bit suspect. Does that concern you as a doctor, how much information is out there that might not be accurate?
Yeah, you hit it on the head on the nail. That is, there's so much information out there, and you know, and it's so easy for anybody to get kind of sucked in by what they're reading. And you know, even sometimes if I'm reading a story, you know, somebody may email me a story from the internet, and you know, sometimes you know when I'm reading it sounds true, and I, you know, and it's sometimes really hard for me to try to disprove some of this stuff because, you know, if they're making some claim that just hasn't really been studied, then it's hard to find anything to counteract that. So it's, yeah, I think it's a huge problem. And we've said this on the show many times. Anybody that watches us, you know, will recognize this. But, you know, the internet is great for researching something that if you've already been diagnosed with something, yeah, you know, the internet is a great tool for linking up with other people with the same problem, things like that, and kind of maybe finding specialists. But But in terms of trying to diagnose yourself, you know, the internet can be a scary place because, you know, medicine is both is half science and half art, and you can get the science part off the internet, but the art is diagnosis. And you know, when we look at patients and we diagnose them, we're basing it on our experience and what we've seen before, and you can't get that from a computer. So, it's funny some of the things you see out there, you know.
Do you think possibly, and that's just the misinformation, even with the correct information, do you think it's possible that we are actually creating a generation of hypochondriacs? Because if I look at a website that gives symptoms of something or other, I mean, everybody's got some symptom of something.
Oh, yeah, right. I mean, pretty much any symptom you could type in, you know, it could be something as mild as nothing. Or a little allergic reaction, or you know, everybody, you know, talking about headaches. I mean, then you start thinking about brain tumors and other things like that, and it's scary. And certainly, if somebody is inquisitive enough about their own symptoms that they're going to the internet, then somebody like that is pretty susceptible to internet hypochondriacism and. Where they're, you know, they're going to think that they have everything they read about. And, you know, most doctors actually do experience that themselves when they're in medical school. We call it the medical student diagnosis. You know, pretty much every time any disease we'd read about when we were first learning about it, you'd suddenly look at yourself and like, oh, wait a minute, I've got that. I might have that, you know. And it's kind of funny because we come in the next day after studying all night and you talk to your fellow students and, like, oh my gosh, I think I have symptoms of lupus or whatever, and you know, but it's just human nature to you know, especially if you're experiencing a problem, you want to identify with something, you want an answer, and you know, and I think that's one of the reasons why the show is so popular, is people are hungry for information, you know, whether it's on our show or when I do my internet chats or on my every Tuesday I take questions on my Twitter. And man, I'm bombarded with just questions from all over the world about you know, people wanting to just ask a doctor something. And you know, I guess it's, you know, I guess I don't see it because I'm a doctor, but I guess people just don't feel like they can go and sit with their doctor and sit there and ask them questions. I guess they feel too much pressure to kind of get in and out in their 15-minute appointment.
Well, that was actually my next question, which you just kind of answered, and that is the popularity of the television show and the response you've been getting since it's been on.
Oh, yeah, huge. You know, we knew it was going to be a good show, but we had no idea that people were just going to gravitate toward it so much. And it is, I think, people that just are hungry to be able to feel like there's a doctor that's accessible to them. And, you know, we come to everybody an hour every day. And, you know, and it just, I think it helps people. I get emails over and over about how people kind of consider us as their second doctor. You know, we always tell them, hey, make sure you have your own doctor too, because, you know, there's only so much we can do over TV. But, you know, I think also the fact that the show is so fast-paced, you know, we don't sit there and talk about one disease for an hour straight, you know, that would get boring. And, you know, it would be great information, but nobody would be watching. But the fact that we just go from one place to another, you know, one day we're talking about, one moment we're talking about diarrhea, the next moment we're talking about head injuries, and then, you know, we come right back and we're talking about women's health issues. You know, it's just all over the place every day, and so people never know what to expect. So I think it keeps them tuning in.
I'm willing to bet that the difference between your specialty and those of other doctors is the reaction or the look of fear in the face of people that you might speak to. And by that I mean, if I came to you as a doctor and say, "Doctor, I think I have this pain," I might not be overly concerned or panicked about it. But people going to a pediatrician for their child, there's a sense of angst, isn't there?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of parents, when they're bringing them into my office, I mean, they've probably been watching their child, you know, get sick over the last couple of days, and they're like, you know, trying to decide, oh, do we go into the office or not? When do we go in? And they finally, the child gets bad enough, okay, we got to go in. And, you know, by that point, the parent's usually pretty worried. And so I usually, you know, luckily with pediatrics, almost 95% of what I see here, you know, I can tell within the first 10 seconds that these kids are going to get better on their own pretty quickly. And so most of my job is reassuring parents. And I think I've gotten pretty good at calming down a nervous parent.
How would you say being a doctor on a television show like The Doctors has changed you? And the reason why I bring that up, just in a recent show, I saw you, for instance, tearing up over a situation that was on. And you must see a lot of different situations, probably even more extreme than you might normally get in your practice.
Yep, exactly. We tackle things on the show that I would never tackle in my office. And I think a recent show that I was tearing up about, it was one of our drug intervention shows where we had some teenagers on that were into just really bad things, you know, some really nasty drugs. And they were just ruining their lives, and where their parents were there, and the kids were giving the parents a hug. And whenever I watch, whenever I'm doing a show like that, it's really hard for me because I start thinking about my own kids. My daughter's 16, and, you know, I thought, you know, I kind of start thinking, I hope her life just would never get to the point where she would turn to drugs. And just the thought of that, you know, makes me tear up. And I just usually didn't deal with that sort of thing in my office. You know, most of my office is, younger kids and doing checkups and ear infections and coughs and runny noses and things like that. In another way the show's changed me is, our trip to Haiti that we did back in late January, February. That was a 3 or 4 days of really intense stuff there. And people that saw that, we were able to air 2 episodes worth of footage from there. And I heard about those shows from around the world, just people just really lending their support to us and saying, hey, we're so glad you guys went and got to see what we did through the cameras. And, that was a life-changing situation, just being down there. It was like a war zone. Hmm. And you come back and just from the all, you know, the hustle and bustle of American life, suddenly traffic doesn't really seem to bother me anymore. And standing in a line in a bank doesn't seem to bother me anymore, you know. The fact that I have a roof over my head and I'm not living in a pile of bricks, you know, like so many of the Haitians are doing still, it makes you just kind of realize how lucky you are. And I kind of wish everybody could go through something like that, just because, you know, it's a shame to see people getting so uptight about, you know, things that really shouldn't matter, you know.
Hmm. I got one last question I want to ask you. You're the son of a pediatrician and a nurse, and also the oldest of 8 siblings. Was there any doubt you'd be a pediatrician, considering all that?
it's kind of funny. I actually, being the oldest of 8, I honestly thought I was kind of, when I went to medical school, I thought, you know, my dad makes it look fun, but I don't know if maybe I've had enough of kids, you know, and. And it wasn't until my 3rd year when I started working in the hospitals and dealing with patients and adult patients and kid patients, and I kind of just noticed that I was a lot more comfortable working with kids since I'd basically been doing it all my whole life already. And so I said, yeah, okay, great, pediatrics is for me. And I had a family business to join, my dad, my brother, and it was just really, you know, a really great fit. It is great. It's great fun because, you know, if you watched me in my office, I really don't, it doesn't seem like I'm working. I'm basically playing with kids all day long, you know, tickling and pretending there's, you know, gumdrops in their ears and all that kind of stuff. But I kind of have a knack at, it looks like I'm playing with the kids, but I'm really examining them and checking them out and making sure they're growing well. But it just makes for a fun day at the office. And, you know, just something, you know, I just love doing, and glad I can do it. You know, my dad, he just recently turned 70, and he's still in the office. So, you know, it's kind of nice to know that, you know, pediatrics, I have a feeling I'll be doing it for a long, long time.
Mm. Well, and we hope you're doing the show, too, for a long, long time. The daily syndicated show is called The Doctors, and you can find it in several places, including here in Canada on the Global Television Network. And as the saying goes, check your local listings. I thank you very much, James, for taking the time to be with us.
All right. Thanks, Peter. Talk to you later.
Dr. James M. Sears, one of the stars of the hit daily syndicated show, The Doctors. You can check out his website at AskDrSears.com. That's AskDrSears.com, AskDrSears.com. And you can find him on Twitter at DrJimSears. You'll, of course, find all the links on my website at TheStuffFile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at Peter@TheStuffFile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
If you're into the paranormal, then you're into Don Ecker and Dark Matters.
Something I have been immersed in for 20 years. Lunar research on items known as lunar transient phenomena. For over 400 years, world-class astronomers have been observing strange sights, lights, flashes, and other things on the moon.
Provocative topics, listeners' calls, and interesting guests.
Guest Mr. Alan Stern.
On my website, I have a list of 100 or so lunar conspiracy theories. I had to kind of come to terms with one of them that I hadn't really thought about.
It's the kind of show that might keep you up at night.
Speculation is, at some time in our past, or perhaps even today, there is another presence on the moon. And I'm not talking about indigenous lunar folks. I'm talking about a space base by somebody else on the far side of the moon.
Dark Matters with Don Ecker, exclusively on CyberStationUSA.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
I've mentioned on many occasions that I'm a big fan of the CBS soap opera As the World Turns. I started watching the show when I was 4 with my mother, so do the math. I've watched that program for almost 50 years. The show is slated to go off the air in September, but what I wanted to talk about here is the passing of the Grand Dame of As the World Turns, Helen Wagner. It was back on April 2nd, 1956, that she uttered the very first words on the very first episode of that show. And in 2010, she was still on the show. Sadly, Helen passed away earlier this month at the age of 91. Growing up while watching her, she almost became like family, which is why I was so thrilled to have the chance to talk with her on the old radio show that I did for many years. It was June 8th of 1994 when Helen graced the airwaves of our show for a full hour. I thought at this time of her passing, I would play just a portion of that conversation. So here now is an edited version of my chat with the great Helen Wagner.
You have been around on that show for 38 years. As a matter of fact, I understand you spoke the very first words on that program.
Even before that, Mr. Holder, I made the pilot film which sold the show. So I've been on it since before it went on the air.
Now, when you say the pilot film, what was that like?
What we did was to make put a show on a kinescope. We didn't have tape back in those days,
mm-hmm.
And they sold it. They sent it around as a selling piece, and Procter & Gamble got interested enough in it to put us on the air. We made that pilot film in November of '55. So this is all prehistory, Lamb.
How did you get the role of Nancy Hughes?
Well, that was an interesting thing. I was working on The World of Mr. Sweeney with Charlie Ruggles. There were three of us who were running parts on Mr. Ruggles, who played a kind of Scattergood Baines character. And I played his daughter, and a young boy by the name of Glenn Walken played my son, Charlie's grandson. Glenn was on Guiding Light at the time and doing both shows. Then after about 5 years, Mr. Ruggles decided that he wanted to go back to California, and neither Glenn nor I wanted to go with him. So Charlie said, all right, then he'd recast, but good luck, and hail and farewell, and off he went. And meanwhile, Glenn's mother said, Erna Phillips and Ted Corday, who were writing and stint on Guiding Light, one as a nurse with the words, how do you do, and another as a nurse saying, the patients are just down the hall. In addition to that, I did an audition with Don McLaughlin, who played Chris for so many years, right. Remember? And we did an audition for Erna and Ted over at the old CBS building. Meanwhile, you see, for 5 years they'd watched me do The World of Mr. Sweeney with Glenn and Mr. Ruggles. So they were thoroughly aware of everything that I might do in front of a camera or in the way I might take direction. That's how I got the job.
How has Nancy changed over the years?
Well, she's grown up. She's matured. She's mellowed. She's gotten less possessive of her family. And she's gotten a lot older. 39 years later.
Now, when you say possessive of her family, that's one thing people talk about when they talk about Nancy, that she did at one point become quite the busybody looking after her children and getting in everyone's way.
Oh, yes, yes. She, whatever was going to be done, she gave them great advice whether they wanted to hear it or not. So I used to get great mail castigating me. Why don't you leave those kids alone? Let them do what they want to. Well, that was fine, you know, just as long as people wrote, even if they didn't like it very much. As long as they wrote, you knew they were attending and were interested in the show.
Do you get a lot of mail over the years?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I don't get nearly as much as the younger kids do, of course. I get a steady line of mail, and I get it from all ages, which is very interesting. First, of course, I got it from just women. Now I get it from children of people who've watched the show, and I get it now from grandchildren who watch the show.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people might not be familiar with your background besides the work you've done as Nancy Hughes. I understand you're originally from Lubbock, Texas?
Yes, my father was a doctor down there in the plains of West Texas.
How does someone from Lubbock, Texas end up on the boards in New York?
Gradually. I went to college in Illinois, and then my piano teacher brought me with her to New York to attend a master class with Abram Chasen's piano class, that was. And I graduated from college with a degree in music and a degree in drama. And after that summer in New York, I just decided, well, that's where I'd like to go. So mother and father said, well, all right, so I came. And I landed in New York on the wings of that hurricane of 1938, just about the time that Czechoslovakia fell. So mm-hmm. It was a pretty exciting time. That's before your time.
The role you play, you have sometimes, and at least in the past, you've had some good sparring with Eileen Fulton, who plays Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all waiting for it, I think, because I see them talking about the show on the computers when I go into the various forums, and people have been waiting for you to dump all over Ellen for a while, and a couple of weeks ago you did.
Yes.
do you enjoy those type of scenes?
Oh, sure. got a little something going, you know, and little conflict, or instead of just being sweetness and light, pouring coffee and opening doors and that sort of thing, you get to yell a little bit.
Was that a problem when you look back at the first, as I mentioned earlier, the first time you were on the show, and the opening line, and we were talking about it off air earlier this afternoon, people were saying, what was the first line? I mentioned it being, good morning, dear, what would you like for breakfast? And a lot of the women say, gee, I don't know who would say that line today.
Well, you see, we've come a long way in these 40, oh, practically 40 years. Life has changed, and people have changed attitudes.
Did you ever during those years say, gee, let's bring Nancy a little more into a little more independent? I mean, she is now, but that did take some time, didn't it?
Well, I wouldn't have said she wasn't independent. She was a figure of that's the way people behaved in those days.
Mm-hmm.
She was not under Chris's thumb by any means. She just was not one of those people who went out and got into civic affairs and ran the town. She stayed home and ran her home. As a matter of fact, Erna Phillips, who wrote us for 20 years, had Nancy staying at home to such a degree that she never wanted to go away on a vacation with Chris, which made it very difficult for Helen Wagner to get away on a vacation. But Erna came up with a sister for me in Kansas City.
So whenever I wanted to go on a vacation, I'd go out and visit Pearl.
I see. Give us a little bit of an idea of how the show has changed from going from live to tape. How is that, and from a half hour to an hour, how has that changed what you do on a daily basis?
I think the biggest change over the years has been in the form of writing. For instance, when we went on the air with half an hour, we had, say, four scenes in the half hour. When we went hour, we had, maybe twice that many, but we had scenes beginning, middle, and end. And when they decided that the audience that they were aiming at was 30 years old and under, then they started doing more episodic writing. They would we would start off with the beginning of a scene, a flash to the middle of a scene that had come from the script of the day before, mm-hmm. then come back to the middle of the first scene, then start another scene. So it's been we play beginning, middle, and end of scenes all spread out through the whole script for the day, and it's much more episodic, which doesn't make for as much ease in playing the scenes for the actors, because you don't get started on a scene and able to play through to the denouement of that particular momentary idea. We have to do a part, then come back and do the next part, and then come back and do another part. And I think that's the biggest change that's happened to us since we went on the air. Of course, one of the things that we started off in black and white, then we went to color, and that was pretty exciting. And now it's ordinary. You look at black and white, and that looks rather strange and interesting. And we've gone from being able to not being able to immediately look at the show to now being able to see the show even as we do it with the monitors on the floor and so on, and also immediate tape. And so far as editing the shows go, they can now take a tape, rearrange all sorts of things in it without changing the original, so that they can see how they want to cut it and still not have to change it to that cutting. They can go back to the original and or go to their cutting as they choose, which to me is just magic. It's like being able to typewrite a whole page and rearrange anything on it that you want to without changing a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's made, of course, editing the show much, much easier and much more interesting.
How has it changed your day from the days when you had to do it live and the time you had to be at the studio to working now, when it could go on for quite a while, I understand?
Well, when we first went on the air, we were there at 7:30, and we stayed through air, which was 1:30 to 2. Then, if we were on the next day, we'd pick up again in half an hour and start on the rehearsals for the next day's show. So, if you were on just that day, your day was 7:30 to 2, and you went home. No questions asked. Well, now, since we tape it, we're in at 7, and we do the majority of the script in the morning because people are fresher. So I'll say maybe out of 24 scenes, we'll do 14 in the morning and 10 in the afternoon. We're supposed to be through with the morning at 1:30 and go into rehearsal for the afternoon show at 1:45, which we're supposed to finish at 6:30 that evening, if we're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Very often we'll go over. Sometimes when we've had big scenes and big weddings and that sort of stuff, we went as late as 7 o'clock the next morning one day, and the people who were doing the show for that particular day had to be ready to go. They left and went right into rehearsal for the next day. That's the worst we've ever done.
The regular actors go through a lot of dialogue. Where do you find the time in that long schedule to even rehearse or memorize your lines?
Memorizing is the easiest part of it.
Really?
Yeah, oh yes. As you go over your lines, whenever you read through them, that helps you start memorizing.
Is part of it due to the fact that you and so many of the other actors in the shows have played the characters for so long that you know to a certain degree how they're going to react to certain things?
That does make a great deal of difference. And if the dialogue isn't written in the way that you feel it should, we've always had the very great privilege of adjusting words, not ideas, but words. If certain words don't fall easily into your character's mouth, you can change those words, but you cannot change the idea. and that's been a great help.
A brief conversation with Helen Wagner from June of 1994. You can find the complete written transcript of that interview on my website. Just go to thestufffile.com to the What's On page for this show, which is number 0038, and you'll find the link to the transcript.
This is The Stuff File.
And we're almost done with this edition of the show. We have time for just one more quick item, and that would be the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
Police in Berwick, Maine made an easy caller in April, solving four residential burglaries. As it turned out, their two suspects, ages 32 and 33, committed the crimes while wearing their GPS monitoring bracelets following an earlier arrest in New Hampshire, and their movements perfectly coincided with the burglar's route. Why would two clowns, who are already wearing ankle bracelets and can be followed and tracked by the authorities, commit other crimes? One reason, and one reason only, they're idiots.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's The Stuff File with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0038. Hope you've enjoyed it. Tell all your friends. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding program number again, number 0038. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/PAHolder and Twitter at twitter.com/PAHolder. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including cyberstationusa.com, kdxradio.com, and also streaming on pcjmedia.com and over the air at World FM 88.5 FM in New Zealand. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.